Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin, Mishkin Law in Chicago. And we've got another wonderful episode for you today. This is the post-election special. We are not ever for a minute going to mention anything about the presidential election or the Senate or the House or any of that kind of stuff. We're not going to talk about what the future may or may not hold for us, given the results of the election, positive, negative, depending on how you look at it. We're just going to talk about the good old Grateful Dead and marijuana, because that's what this show is all about. Now, there's a little politics involved with marijuana. We touched on that in last week's episode because we had already heard when we were taping that the adult use bill in Florida had failed. But we've got some interesting stuff to talk about as it regards to that. Some interesting music news that we're going to touch upon. We have a really, really good show today. It's the Grateful Dead from 51 years ago today, November 11th, 1973, at Winterland Arena. And this is how it begins.
Left my home in Norfolk, Virginia, California, on my mind. Straddled that Greyhound and rode it past Raleigh, on across Carolina. Stopped in Charlotte, mile past Rocket, we never was a minute late. And we was 9 miles out of Atlanta by Sunday, rolled across Georgia State. Trained into a struggle halfway across Alabama. The hound broke down and left us all standing in downtown Birmingham.
Promised Land, a song written by Chuck Berry. The song was first recorded in this version by Berry in 1964 for his album St. Louis to Liverpool, released in December 1964. It was Berry's fourth single issued following his prison term for a Mann Act conviction. The record peaked at number 41 in the Billboard charts on January 16, 1965. Berry wrote the song while in prison and borrowed an atlas from the prison library to plot the itinerary. In the lyrics, the singer, who refers to himself as the poor boy, tells of his journey from Norfolk, Virginia, to the Promised Land, Los Angeles, California, mentioning various cities and southern states that he passes through on his journey. Describing himself as a poor boy, the protagonist boards a Greyhound bus in Norfolk, Virginia, that passes Raleigh, North Carolina, stops in Charlotte, bypasses Rock Hill, South Carolina. The bus rolls out of Atlanta, but breaks down, leaving him stranded in downtown Birmingham, Alabama. He then takes a train across Mississippi clean to New Orleans. From there, he goes to Houston, where the people there who care a bit about him buy him a silk suit, luggage, and a plane ticket to Los Angeles. Upon landing in Los Angeles, he calls Norfolk, Virginia, Tidewater 41009, to tell the folks back home he made it to the Promised Land. The lyric, "Swing low, sweet chariot, come down easy, taxi to the terminal zone," refers to the gospel lyric, "Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home," since both refer to a common destination, the Promised Land, which in this case is California, reportedly, or as far as Berry was concerned, a heaven on earth. Billboard called the song a true blue Berry rocker with plenty of get up and go, adding that rinky piano and wailing Berry electric guitar fills all in neatly. Cashbox described it as a pull out all the stops rocker that Chuck pounds out as solid sales authority and a real mover that should head out for hit territory in no time flat. In 2021, it was listed number 342 on Rolling Stone's top 500 greatest songs of all time. apparently played by the Warlocks and the Grateful Dead in their earliest days. Bob Weir started playing this with the Dead in 1971, and it remained a regular right through the band's last show ever in 1995. Among those deeply touched by Chuck's genius were Jerry Garcia and other members of the Dead. They often paid homage to Chuck by weaving his songs into their performance, breathing new life into his timeless melodies. Promised Land, with its relentless drive, became an anthem of journey and aspiration. Their electrifying renditions of Johnny B. Goode were not mere covers, but jubilant celebrations of a narrative that resonated with the dreamer in all of us. The Grateful Dead's performances of Around and Around echoed Chuck's mastery of capturing life's cyclical rhythm and dancing in a dance of beginning and endings, joy and sorrow. And when they took on Run, Rudolph, Run, they infused the festival classic with their own psychedelic flair, bridging the gap between tradition and innovation. A moment etched in musical history was when Chuck Berry shared the stage with the Grateful Dead during their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1994. The air was thick with reverence and electricity, a meeting of titans where the past, present, and future of rock converged in harmonious resonance. Again, in May 1995, Chuck opened for the Grateful Dead in Portland, Oregon. It was a night where legends collided and the music swirled like tempest, leaving a lasting impression on all who were fortunate enough to witness it. This version really rocks out. I especially love piano, which is featured prominently in this clip and makes it well worth it for you to go out and download this show and just check it out from start to finish. The clips can't do it justice. It's an absolutely incredible show. The Dead played Promised Land 430 times. First played on May 28, 1971 at Winterland, and the final time it was played was the final Grateful Dead show on July 9, 1995 at Soldier Field in Chicago. So this was a very, very cool show. We touched last week on the Dead playing in Hamilton, New York at Colgate University, and this is a few years earlier, but it's still part of that same spirit, I think, where it was everybody could feel and knew that 73 was a good year. This is a famous show from a famous year. And I think that people feel 73 was the peak of the band's post-psychedelic era. Certainly right up there with 1977 as top years for the band. Even by November of 73, they were still in full stride during a three-night run in Winterland, this being the third and final night of the run. In 2008, the Dead released the box set Winterland 1973, the complete recordings, featuring the shows of November 9th, 10th, and 11th, 1973. This was the Dead's second complete recordings release, featuring all the nights of a single multi-night run. The first was Fillmore West, 1969, the complete recordings, from February 27th to 28th and March 1st and 2nd, which in my humble opinion I think is the best collection of live music ever released by the band. The band later released a follow-up, Winterland 1977, the complete recordings, which were a three-night run of June 7th, 8th, and 9th, 1977, that is also another truly outstanding box set, three great shows. Winterland was just a place that brought out the best of them. For instance, let's take a look at today's show. As we say, from 51 years ago, 11-11-1973, 16 songs in the first set, a six-song second set, and a three-song encore, a true rarity for a Dead show of any era, other than maybe New Year's Eve shows, to have such a multi-song encore and really such a short second set. However, the second set consists of Mississippi Half Step, Big River, Dark Star with a Mind Left Body Jam, Into Eyes of the World, China Doll, and Sugar Magnolia, and is as well played as any set ever played by the band. It's just they're on fire, and it just builds and builds upon itself, and all the way through to the end, the Sugar Magnolia rocks out. They were on fire for these three nights. There's no doubt about it. It's a great collection of music and a killer three-night run for those lucky to have snagged a ticket for any or all of the nights. Patrick Carr wrote in the New York Times that the Dead had learned how to conceive and perform a music which often induced something closely akin to the psychedelic experience. They were and are experts in the art and science of showing people another world or a temporary altering, raising of world consciousness. It sounds pseudo-mystical, pretentious perhaps, but the fact is that it happens, and it is intentional. So you just kind of get what you get with the Grateful Dead, but this was just a really special night, I think, for anyone. Again, the people who were able to get out there for all three. Some people suggest that Saturday night was the killer night of the three, From my listening to it, I have to say I put Sunday on a slightly higher step, but it's a really kind of silly argument, right? Because all three of the shows are shows that you would immediately come home and run and call your buddies and say, oh my God, you can't believe the show that I just saw. They were those kind of shows, and the fact that they put three of them together right in a row like that is just a testament to their ability to come in and carry 3 and 4 night runs as well as anybody with their vast catalog of music. Sometimes they would double up on songs or even triple up on songs if they were right in the band's wheelhouse at that moment. But, you know, they would still play so many different songs. It was always, again, the great way to get a number of songs checked off your list if you could see a 3 or 4 show run, because they would try as much as possible not to go back and repeat songs if they could avoid it. And by that, I mean, you know, depending on the mood they were in, the frame of mind they were in, what Jerry was looking for, and, you know, all that other good kind of stuff. But back to this show, because it just really is a wonderful, wonderful night. And coming out of the Promised Land show opener, they went into Bertha, Greatest Story Ever Told, Sugary, Black-Throated Wind. I mean, just a colossal way to come in and open up a show. And then they came out of that and they played this tune. David Dodd, who I like to quote as often as I can when I'm talking about these songs, because he just has a unique way of interpreting dead lyrics and talking about the songs, and it just provides great content and information to me. So here's what he had to say about To Lay Me Down. Is one of the magical trio of lyrics composed in a single afternoon in 1970 in London over a half bottle of Retsina, according to Robert Hunter. The other two songs that he wrote that day were Ripple and Broke Down Palace. Well, first, wouldn't we all like to have a day like that? And second, what unites these three lyrics, aside from the fact that they were all written on the same day? Hunter wrote in his foreword to the complete annotated Grateful Dead lyrics, and I wrote reams of bad songs, bitching about everything under the sun, which I kept to myself. Cast not thy swines before pearls. And once in a while, something would sort of pop out of nowhere. The sunny London afternoon, I wrote Broke Down Palace, To Lay Me Down, and Ripple, all keepers, was in no way typical, but it remains in my mind as the personal quintessence of the union between writer and muse, a promising past and a bright future prospects melding into one great glowing pocatastis, which I can't pronounce and don't really know what it means, but apocatastasis, for those of you at home who want to check it out. To Lay Me Down was written a while before the others that all were on the Garcia album, on the same day as the lyric, well, not Ripple, on the same day as the lyrics to Broke Down and Ripple, the second day, actually not Broke Down either, those were both on American Beauty, sorry. The second day of my first visit to England, I found myself left alone in Alan Trist's flat on Devonshire Terrace in West Kensington with a supply of very nice, thick linen paper, sun shining brightly through the windows, a bottle of Greek Retsina wine at my elbow. The songs flowed like molten gold onto the page and stand as written. The images for To Lay Me Down were inspired in Hampstead Heath, the original title to the song the day before. Lying on the grass and clover on a day of swallow-tailed clouds across from Jack Straw's Castle, a pub now closed and converted into flats, reunited with the girlfriend of my youth after a long separation. Garcia's setting for the words is, like his music for those other two songs, perfect. The three-quarter time, coupled with the gospel style of the melody and chords, makes for a dreamy, beauty-soaked song. I heard it on the radio today. Yes, on the radio, and no, not on a Grateful Dead hour, but just in the course of regular programming. This is, again, David Dodd. And it struck me that it was a gorgeous vehicle for Garcia's voice, by which I mean for that strongly emotive, sweet but not sappy, rough but not unschooled instrument that was Garcia's alone. I have started to think that my usual recitation of where a song was first played, where it was last played, and where it was recorded by the band borders on pointless. All that info is readily available. What's interesting about the performance history of To Lay Me Down is that it was dropped from the rotation for more than 200 shows three different times, and that its final performance in 1992 came 125 shows after the penultimate one. The reappearance of the song in the 1980 acoustic shows came nearly 6 years after the previous performances in 1974. Ripple had a similar pattern, reappearing in those 1980 acoustic sets after 550 performances, or nearly 10 years of shows. Of the magical trio from that day of molten gold in West Kensington, Broke Down Palace had the most solid place in the Dead's performance rotation, with only one huge gap in its appearances, 165 shows between 1977 and 1979. So in terms of story, what can be discerned? The short version for me, even if it's just for a day, even if it's just once, even if it's just one last time, it's worth it. It's golden. It's home. To which I say this version is really great. Listen, it's really great to listen to. Jerry's voice is still so young and strong. His playing is magnificent. The group's singing works well, and they all kill it on their instruments. Jerry with his lead guitar jamming, Bobby with his fills, Phil just keeping things going. As we said, the song was released on the album Garcia, Jerry's first solo album, coming out in 1972. The boys played the song 64 times. It was first played on July 30th, 1970, at the Matrix in San Francisco, California, and it was played for the last time on June 28th, 1992, at Deer Creek Music Center in Noblesville, Indiana. A really beautiful tune, played so well that night, as we say, it came out of Black Throated Wind. They went into El Paso, Ramble on Rose, me and Bobby McGee, and we will get to more songs in the show in a minute. But first, we are going to take a little detour, like we often do at this time, to listen to a little music news. Dan, what have you got for us on the musical intro to music news?
The lunatic is on the grass. The lunatic is on the grass, remembering games and daisy chains and laughs. Got to keep the loonies on the path. The lunatic is in the hall. The lunatics are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor. And every day the paper boy brings more.
So, Brain Damage is the ninth track from Pink Floyd's 1973 album, The Dark Side of the Moon. It was sung on record by Roger Waters, with harmonies by David Gilmour, who would continue to sing it on his solo tours. Gilmour sang the lead vocals when Pink Floyd performed it live on their 1994 tour, as can be heard on their live release, Pulse. The band originally called this track Lunatic during live performances and recording sessions. Brain Damage was released as a digital single on January 19th, 2023, to promote the Dark Side of the Moon 50th anniversary box set. The uncredited Manic Laughter is that of Pink Floyd's then road manager, Peter Watts. The Dark Side of the Moon is the eighth studio album by the English rocker Pink Floyd, released on March 1, 1973 by Harvest Records in the United Kingdom and Capitol Records in the United States. Developed during live performances before recording began, it was conceived as a concept album that would focus on the pressures faced by the band during their arduous lifestyle and also deal with the mental health problems of the former band member, Syd Barrett, who had departed the group in 1968. New material was recorded in two sessions in 1972 and 1973 at EMI Studios, now Abbey Road Studios, in London. The Dark Side of the Moon is among the most critically acclaimed albums and often features in professional listings of the greatest of all time. It brought Pink Floyd international fame, wealth, and plaudits for all four band members. A blockbuster release of the album era, it also propelled record sales through the music industry during the 1970s. The Dark Side of the Moon is certified 14 times platinum in the United Kingdom and topped the U.S. Billboard Top LPs and Tape chart, where it has charted for 990 weeks. 990 weeks. By 2013, The Dark Side of the Moon had sold over 45 million copies worldwide, making it the band's best-selling release, the best-selling album of the 1970s, and the fourth best-selling album in history. In 2012, the album was selected for preservation in the United States National Recording Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. It was introduced into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1999. Good buddy Harold and I, back in the day when we were still in high school, and I would pop up from St. Louis to visit in Highland Park, him and all of our other friends from summer camp up in Eagle River, Wisconsin, Camp Ramah, and we'd all get up there and get together, and then at the end of the night, I would go back to Harold's, where I was staying, and, you know, we were so clever, we'd wait for his parents to go to bed or assume they were in bed, and we'd go downstairs and hit his dad's liquor cabinet, and of all things, we'd pull out Southern Comfort and sit around and do shots of Southern Comfort and then stagger back upstairs, and he would put on Dark Side of the Moon, and he'd fall asleep and start snoring, but I'd listen to it all the way through to the end, and Brain Damage was definitely one of my favorites. I think the name Lunatic probably came out and stuck to one or two of our girlfriends from the time, but maybe not. I can't quite remember. That was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But it is where I really first fell in love with Pink Floyd and really decided that this was Dark Side of the Moon was just an amazing album, and been a fan ever since, notwithstanding my political and philosophical differences with Roger Waters on just about every topic under the sun. Now, moving on with Pink Floyd, but not with Roger Waters, I'm going to try and address an urban rumor about Pink Floyd that's been around for as long as the Dark Side of the Moon album has been around. I've never personally put it to the test, but I have friends, including good buddy Rob, who I often go to shows with, who have tried it and who swear that there does seem to be a correlation. And that is, David Gilmour addresses the synchronicity theory between the Dark Side of the Moon and the Wizard of Oz. On Thursday, November 7th, 2024, Pink Floyd's David Gilmour appeared on The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon amid his extensive run at New York's Madison Square Garden, where he is supporting his latest solo release, Luck and Strange. During the music industry legend stopped by the late night talk show, he spoke with the program's host, who questioned the theory of synchronicity between the Dark Side of the Moon and the Wizard of Oz, commonly referred to as the Dark Side of the Rainbow. "You said that you think it's your best work since Dark Side of the Moon," Fallon questioned at the top of the segment, comparing Gilmour's comments regarding his latest release and the Pink Floyd classic. "When we finished Dark Side, there was a lot of crossfades and stuff between all the tracks. They had all to be done separately, and when they all have to be edited in the old days before Pro Tools, When we finally finished, we sat down in the control room at Abbey Road and listened to it all the way through. And wow, I guess all of us have the feeling that it was something quite amazing, that we got it. And at the same point on this album, I had a very similar feeling, which is why I said that. Fallon stewed on Luck and Strange during a series of follow-up questions that assisted in painting a portrait of familial involvement during the making of Gilmour's 2024 release, harnessing the conversation to the artist's preferred homebred approach before they segued into the realm of the Emerald City. Fallon landed on the topic of Oz during a bit aimed at busting rumors that have populated throughout the musician's 60-year tenure in the spotlight. The Pink Floyd album Dark Side of the Moon was written to synchronize with the movie Wizard of Oz, Fallon suggested, prompting Gilmour's humor-tinged response, "Well, of course it was." Fallon threw his hands up in response, acting on the comedic angle before the musician clarified, "No, no, we listened to it, Polly and I, years ago." Fallon stopped the artist to ask, "There's no planning that out?" Gilmour continued, "No, no, I mean, I only heard about it years later. Somebody said that you put the needle on vinyl, that is, and on the third, you know, you've got the film running somehow, on the third roar of the MGM Lion, you put the needle on the beginning of Dark Side of the Moon, and there's these strange synchronicities that happen." Fallon asked Gilmour if he had ever tested the theory, to which he exclaimed, "Yeah," he went on to admit, and there are these strange coincidences. I'll just call them coincidences. So take that for what you will. David Gilmour says no, but then he kind of suggests that maybe it is there and that he's seen it himself. I don't know. I've never tried it. Good buddy Rob has, and maybe someday I'll get him to try it again, and I can sit there and bear witness to it with him and see if it really does, in fact, link up, in any manner like that makes it a topic worthwhile and continuing to talk about, or have we all just been taken by an urban legend for all these many years? So we will find out and we will see. Significant interest to me, to my wife, to a good friend Andy, and others, Joni Mitchell turned 81 on November 7th. She was born in 1943, making her 81 this past Thursday. Mitchell began her career in small nightclubs in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada, and grew to become one of the most influential singer-songwriters in modern music history. Rising to fame during the 1960s, Mitchell became a key narrator in the folk music movement alongside others like Bob Dylan. Over the decades, she has released 19 studio albums, including the seminal album Blue, which was rated the third best album ever made in Rolling Stone's 2020 list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. In 2023, Joni Mitchell at Newport was released, a live album of her 2022 performance at the Newport Folk Festival. More recently, she was the featured performer at the Joni Jam at the Gorge in George Washington in June of 2023. And Brandi Carlile was very instrumental in setting all of that up. My wife was there. Andy was there. Other friends of theirs, Amy and Lori, were there with them. It's gotten great reviews, great write-ups. They've had versions of Joni Jams since that time, but I think it's hard to beat the combination of what was basically the first one of them and being at a place like the Gorge and all of the beautiful natural surroundings and place I've never been to, but I hear my wife talk about it now and Andy talk about it, and I have seen pictures of it, and it's one of those places that is on a bucket list of venues that I would like to go to one day, preferably to see a band that I would really like to see out there, like Fish or, Goose or, some of those kind of guys. But, I would go to see a lot of different bands out there if they were going to play at the Gorge. I think it would really just be a cool place that I'm looking forward to doing someday. But happy birthday to Joni. Turning 81 is incredible. God love her. And, may she just go on forever. And we'll see what happens. Speaking of birthdays, Dan Lebowitz turned 50, is turning 50, and he has announced details pertaining to the Dan Lebowitz 50th birthday bash. The event is slated to take place on Saturday, November 23rd, 2024, and function as a celebratory occasion to honor the jam stalwart and beloved member of the Bay Area music scene's 5-decade ride. I didn't say this, but it will be at the Sweetwater Music Hall in Mill Valley, California. the six-string virtuoso known for his work with Animal Liberation Orchestra, ALO, Phil Lesh and Friends, and his own self-titled Friends Project, has tapped an all-star group of regional talent to assist during the live show. Appearing on the birthday lineup, in addition to the band leader, are Vicky Randall, percussion vocals, the Tonight Show Band, Steve Adams, bass from ALO, Trevor Garrett, keys from Tea Leaf Green, and Scott Rager, the drummer also of Tea Leaf Green. Possessing a signature tone, the vehicle for his fluid, buttery sound is a flat-top acoustic guitar that he has personally sliced and diced into an electric flat-top with vintage-style humbucker pickup. Inherently committed to an improvisational approach, Lebo embodies the realm of melodic and soulful sounds. The press release includes drawing on the unique factors which have made Lebo a standout amongst his musical contemporaries. As an added distinction and play into the birthday angle of events, surprise, and celebration, special guest appearances are slated to occur as referenced via press release and the artist posts on Instagram, where he noted additional inclusions as to be announced. So there you have it. A bunch of birthdays. Dan Lebo. Lebowitz to go out and celebrate his big time. Lebo is a favorite of good buddy Alex and Andy from San Francisco. Wouldn't be surprised if they make it over there to celebrate with him for this fine occasion on November 23rd, which, of course, is just about 2 weeks from today. So very exciting, and 2 weeks from yesterday, or 2 days ago, rather. I'm taping on Sunday, but it was, for you guys, 2 days ago on Saturday. Very, very exciting. Anyone who can make it out there for that, I'm sure it will be a wonderful experience. And anytime somebody is playing in Mill Valley and says more special guests to be announced, that's kind of like I've learned and figured out, you know, home base for a huge number of musical legends and people in the music industry who we all love to listen to. So, you know, anybody could be out for a quart of milk and say, oh, I'm going to pop in there and play a few songs and then go get my milk and take it home to my lovely wife or spouse or other, whoever it might be. So, yeah, that would be kind of a cool thing to see. And I'll have to check with Alex and Andy and see if they are going. And if so, see if I can get a little update on it for us to share. But let's turn back to our show from November 11th, 1973, 51 years ago today. And this is really special that they played right to the very end, right at the very end of the first set.
Clean.
So this is the entire Weather Report Suite. We were just listening to the transition from Weather Report Suite Part 1 into Weather Report Suite Part 2, otherwise known as Let It Grow. They also played the Weather Report's prelude, which came out of a blistering China Cat, I Know You writer, Me and My Uncle and Loose Lucy. The prelude fed into Weather Report Suite Part 1, and then, as we just heard, it led into the Part 2, Let It Grow, which closed out the first set, 16 songs. Just an incredible first set of music by the Grateful Dead. Once again, David Dodd talking about this particular piece of music, Weather Report Suite, the prelude, Part 1 and Part 2. For a short time, the three pieces that comprised the suite were played as such, but that was a relatively short shift, excuse me, by Grateful Dead standards. The prelude debuted in November 1972, originally as a separate piece from its eventual companions. The Dead played it, according to Dead Bass, four more times in the spring of 1973 before it was first matched up with Weather Report Suite Parts 1 and 2 in September of that year. It was played regularly through October of 1974 and then dropped from the repertoire. The instrumental prelude, composed by Weir, sets the stage for the two pieces to follow. I think it's one of the most beautiful little pieces of music I know. I have never once skipped through it over the years of listening. I just let it wash over me and know that its simplicity and beauty are preparing me for the melancholy of Part 1 and the sometimes epic grandeur of Part 2. Part 1 is a song written with Eric Anderson, a well-known singer-songwriter who wrote the classic Thirsty Boots. He was on the Festival Express tour of Might As Well fame across Canada with the Dead, and I'm guessing that's where Weir and he met and concocted this piece. Happy to correct it on that by anyone who knows better. Anderson and Weir share the lyric credit, and the music is credited to Weir. Once it disappeared in the rotation in September 1973, it stayed in the repertoire. Once it appeared in the rotation in September of 1973, it stayed in the repertoire only as long as the prelude did, dropping entirely in October of 1974. The song addresses the seasons and their changing mirrors, and their changing mirrors, the singer's state of mind as he reflects on the coming of love, and maybe it's going too, a circle of seasons and the blooming and fading of roses. I particularly like the line, "And the seasons will end in tumbled rhyme and little change the wind of rain." There's something very hopeful buried in the song's melancholy. Is that the melancholy just a projection of mine? I think there's something about Weir's singing that gets at that emotion. Loss and the hope that there might be new love. Weather Report Suite Part 2, Let It Grow, is a very different beast. It remained steadily in the rotation for the next 21 years after its debut, and the band played it some 276 times. Its season of rarity was 1979, when it was only played three times, but otherwise it was not far from the rotation. It could be stretched into a lengthy jamming tune, clocking in at over 15 minutes several times, building to a thundering crescendo, and the Weather Report aspect of the song is what was really the most fun many, many times. It was all released on Wake of the Flood in 1973. Weather Report, the prelude and part one were played a total of 46 times together, the first on September 8th, 1973 at Nassau Veterans Coliseum in Uniondale, New York, last played on October 18th, 1974 at the Winterland Arena in San Francisco, California. So we didn't really listen to a whole lot of the Let It Grow, a little more focused today on the prelude and on part one. We get Let It Grow from time to time in a number of other shows, but it's really nice when you get a show like this where you can really do something like this and have a chance to kind of feature it and talk about it a little bit. It's great stuff. I really love that music. This was a great time for it. They were really doing a lot, and to get to hear it all, I think, is really, really special. So the boys come out of that, now they come out to start the second set, and here's how the second set started.
Say that when your ship comes in, first man takes the sins, second takes the after death, the third planks and rails. What's the point of calling shots? This queue is straight in line. You balls made up, star up.
Mississippi Half Step, Uptown Toodaloo, released on Wake of the Flood in 1973. It was first performed live by the Grateful Dead on July 16th, 1972. It was a frequent part of the repertoire through to 1974. From 1976 onward, it was played less frequently, with usually between 5 and 15 performances each year. It was not played at all in 83 and 84. The last performance was in July 1995. In total, it was performed around 236 times. The majority of performances from 1978 onward were as opening songs of a show. Hunter Garcia special, great story, great lyrics. What's the point of calling shots? This cue ain't straight in line. Cue ball is made of styrofoam, and no one's got the time. You got to love lyrics like that. Always one of my favorite songs to hear in concert. The Half Step into Franklin's was an especially fun opener, a great 1-2 punch, really getting things going, and a great way to do it. As I said before, the song was played by the Dead 236 times, first on July 16th, 1972, at Dillon Stadium in Hartford, Connecticut, last played on July 6th, 1995, at the Riverport Amphitheater in Maryland Heights, St. Louis, Missouri. So now we're going through the show. This was the second set opener. They then played this into Big River, which is a really, really excellent Big River. Just not enough time to feature all the songs. And then from Big River, they go into Dark Star. And that's where we'll pick them back up in a few minutes. But right now, we're going to dive into the marijuana news of the day. And I'm sure, as always, Dan's got something for us.
I've been warped by the rain, driven by the snow, drunk and dirty, don't you know, and I'm still willing. Out on the road, late at night, seeing my pretty Alice in every headlight. Alice. Dallas Alice. And I've been from Tucson to Tucumcari, to Hatchapeta, Tonopah, driven every kind of rig that's ever been made. Driven the back roads so I wouldn't get away. And if you give me weed, white sand, show me a sign, I'll be willing to be moving. Play it, Billy.
Willin', a beautiful song written by Lowell George, a true music legend, first recorded with his group Little Feet on their 1971 debut album. The song has since been performed by a variety of artists. George wrote the song while he was a member of the Mothers of Invention. When George sang an early version of the song for bandleader Frank Zappa, Zappa suggested that the guitarist form his own band rather than continue under Zappa's tutelage. George did just that, and the song was subsequently recorded by his band Little Feet. The song was included on Little Feet's 1971 self-titled album, and the band re-recorded the song at a slower tempo to much greater success on their 1972 Sailin' Shoes album. A live version recorded in 1977 appears on their 1978 Waiting for Columbus, one of my all-time favorite live albums. The lyrics are from the point of view of a truck driver who was driven from Tucson, Arizona, to Tucumcari, New Mexico, to Tehachapi, California, and then back to Tonopah, Arizona, and smuggled some smokes and folks from Mexico. The song has become a trucker anthem. And of course, he asks for weed, very drawn out there. I like that. Whites, which took me a little while of time at Ann Arbor to learn from the guys who knew, meant speed, and wine, to get him through his drive. At the end there, after he's done singing, he says, "Play it, Billy." He's referring to Billy Payne, who was the Little Feat keyboard player, who I think is just an absolutely outstanding keyboard player. And as you could hear, he was really beautiful sound there. And anytime you want to go back and listen to Little Feat, boy, they're rock solid. And we could talk about them all day and maybe for a couple of shows, all their great albums, all their great music. But it's always nice when they make it easy for us. We all love Little George. And that was a great song. He really enjoyed singing it all the time. And good for him. We miss him, and we miss Little Feat. That was a band that good buddy Mikey really turned me on to. He turned me on to a lot of really good bands. And I remember listening to my song a few times, but unfortunately, after Little George had died, so I never had the pleasure of seeing Mr. George up there on stage singing with them or anybody else. And that's just too bad for me. But I listened to all of his albums and the band's albums, and just really spectacular stuff. So that's a beautiful lead-in song and a lot of fun. And we're going to dive right into our marijuana content today. Thank you, as always, to Marijuana Moment for providing such wonderful content, MJ Biz 2. And the first story that we hear about is that a new study on the impact of marijuana consumption on people's use of other drugs suggests that for many, cannabis may act as a less dangerous substitute, allowing people to reduce their intake of substances such as alcohol, methamphetamine, and opioids like morphine. The survey of 23,500 people in New Zealand asked participants about whether their use of cannabis had any influence on their consumption of other substances. For the most part, it found that marijuana use was associated with reduced frequency and quantity of use of other certain substances. Significant proportions reported cannabis use led to less alcohol, 60%, synthetic cannabinoid, 60%, morphine, 44%, and methamphetamine, 40% use, the new report says. Those who reported using less had lower frequency and amount used of other drugs. That said, results varied by substance as well as by demographics. Nearly 70% of the people said cannabis had no impact on LSD, MDMA, or cocaine use, for example. One-third of cannabis and tobacco co-users reported using less tobacco, while an even smaller minority of respondents, 1 in 5, reported that using marijuana actually led to more tobacco use. Substituting cannabis for other drugs also appears more popular among young adults aged 21 to 35, who are more likely than other groups to report that cannabis lowered their consumption of alcohol and methamphetamine. Students and people living in cities, meanwhile, were less likely to say that marijuana reduced their use of other drugs. Use of marijuana by adolescent 16 to 20-year-olds, meanwhile, had mixed results, with the cohort being both more likely to report cannabis use resulting in more and less other substances use compared to having no impact, the study found. Young adults 21 to 25 years old, by contrast, were more likely to say cannabis use resulted in lower use of alcohol, methamphetamine, and MDMA. The results contribute to what's still a mixed picture in terms of whether and to what extent people are using marijuana as a substitute for other drugs, authors noted. For example, they note a study of U.S. college students found that following cannabis legalization, there was a reduction in binge drinking alcohol among students 21 or older, but not as much among younger students, while at the same time, other studies of U.S. college students found no impact on other drug use. Similarly, conflicting outcomes have been seen in jurisdictions that have legalized marijuana, the study points out. For instance, it says monthly purchases of alcohol, specifically wine, declined in Colorado and Washington states after legalization of recreational cannabis, while purchases of spirits increased in Washington in-state, but decreased in Oregon after cannabis legalization. Another study found Canada-wide monthly beer sales dropped after cannabis legalization, but there was no change in spirit sales, reports added. In contrast, other studies in U.S. legalization states found cannabis legalization resulted in no change in alcohol purchase and use. Venturing to explain the association, authors note that it comes to drinking, the substitution of legal cannabis for alcohol may reflect the similar neurological effects of each substance, similar social acceptability among young people, and comparable price, adding that some studies of college students have found some were motivated to use cannabis as a means to reduce their alcohol consumption and the related negative outcomes. They also point to another recent literature review suggesting the cannabis and alcohol interactions may be age-dependent, suggesting that older age may moderate the level of substitution and complementary behavior. Our findings have a number of implications for harm reduction, the new paper says. Firstly, greater access to cannabis could provide opportunities for older young adults, 20 years old plus, to reduce excessive alcohol consumption within an age group with high prevalence of risky drinking. Cannabis may provide a lower risk option than heavy alcohol use among young adults who are in a particularly hedonistic phase of their lives. Secondly, authors said, greater access to cannabis could play a part in reducing methamphetamine use for some individuals, either as a means to reduce the frequency of methamphetamine consumption or as an adjunct to support treatment for methamphetamine-related issues. Several harm reduction studies have indicated the potential of medicinal cannabis to support reduction in the use of other drugs that have higher risk of side effects, including stimulants and prescription of opioid analgesics. So there's just a whole lot to this story that just kind of goes on and on. But the bottom line is that here's another study finding a positive outcome, a positive benefit of societal acceptance and use of marijuana in younger people, in other groups of people, lower consumption of alcohol, which we all know, if you don't know by now, you haven't been paying attention, to be far, far more harmful to the human body than marijuana. The key difference being, of course, that sticked with me altogether. Alcohol can kill you. Marijuana cannot. And that's the direct effects of the substance. Not you might get high and go out and do something stupid, or you might get drunk and go out and do something stupid. But the drinking of alcohol over time will kill you. The smoking of marijuana over time will not kill you. Opioids, people become addicted to them, and they will kill you. And once again, we find that there's a large group of people out there who have made this link between marijuana and its ability to substitute in for alcohol, opioids, and methamphetamines and other stuff out there. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And, you know, you wonder if folks down in Florida who passed their measure by a majority, but not a constitutional 60% majority, must feel pretty bummed out that they're being denied this benefit, at least on a legal basis. I'm sure they can get all the marijuana they want, which is to say to Governor DeSantis, screw you, fool. All you've done is deprive the state of an opportunity to make money on the sale and use of a product that's going to be continuing on no matter what. So that leads us to our second story, which is why Florida's marijuana legalization ballot initiative failed, despite the fact that it had Donald Trump's support and his endorsement and historic funding and a majority of the support. So the story reads that despite historic levels of funding, a rigorous advertising campaign, and an endorsement from former President Donald Trump, along with clear majority voter support at the ballot box, a Florida marijuana legalization initiative was defeated at the polls on Tuesday, leaving industry stakeholders scratching their heads as they tried to assess what exactly went wrong. Amendment 3 got about 57% of the vote, but it came up 3% short of the 60% threshold required to pass a constitutional amendment at the ballot box under Florida state law. Several polls predicted a different outcome, but the final vote was entirely a surprising look at the full breadth of surveys and taking into account margins of error. That gives little solace to the Smart and Safe Florida campaign or the cannabis companies and individual donors who collectively contributed more than $150 million to get legalization enacted into law in the Sunshine State. The multi-state cannabis operator Trulieve provided the lion's share of financing for the campaign. The defeat was felt strongly among industry investors in the election aftermath too. So what happened? Well, Trump, who is now the president-elect after defeating Vice President Kamala Harris on Tuesday last week, amped up hopes that the initiative would pass after he gave his own endorsement and predicted voters would follow his lead. In making the endorsement, he made this the first U.S. presidential election where both party candidates voiced support for ending prohibition at some level, though Trump focused on state-level reform while Harris-backed federal reform. Proved insufficient, however, because even with Amendment 3 getting more votes on Election Day than either the GOP or Democratic presidential nominee received, the campaign still failed. On the other side of the issue, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis aggressively campaigned against Amendment 3, telling voters the measure was written by self-interested marijuana companies in an effort to corner the market. Part of his rationale was the fact that there was not an explicit home grow option for adults, even though he has not personally advocated for the legislature to enact that reform. Some advocates for cannabis reform shared the governor's stated concerns about the structure of the legal market. Florida's rejection of Amendment 3 echoes a similar message sent by Ohio voters in 2015, where they struck down a measure that would have granted exclusive growing rights to just 10 producers. Shailene Tidal, founder of the Parabola Center for Law and Policy, told Marijuana Moment. In both cases, voters rejected proposals that would have created highly concentrated markets, favoring a small number of entities funding the effort. Amendment 3's near total funding by Trulieve raised legitimate concerns about market fairness and consumer choice. The measure's failure to include provisions for social equity, home cultivation, or limits on industry consolidation suggests voters are thinking critically, not just about whether to legalize, but how to do it in a way that benefits consumers and communities, not just large corporations, she said. This is consistent with our research on American beliefs and values around legalization. Under the initiative, there was no mandate to provide additional cannabis business licenses. And to that point, without legislative action, the reform would presumably give the state's existing medical marijuana businesses, including those that funded the campaign, an advantage right out of the gate. But nothing about the measure restricted lawmakers and regulators from expanding the market either. While there is no data on what share of voters who opposed the initiative would have otherwise supported a legalization measure that did not include home cultivation or mandated an expanding licensing structure, conversation about those issues did happen among some members of the cannabis community on social media. DeSantis also repeatedly made the case that, as written, the measure would have upended Florida's culture and turned it into something closer to California, Colorado, or New York. The smell of cannabis would pollute Florida's air, he suggested, on multiple occasions. Just naming blue, liberal-leaning states, people in Florida take pride in identifying that they are not those. I think that messaging was really effective, Paul Armentano, deputy director of Normal, told Marijuana Moment. I think his claim about the smell being everywhere and we don't want to turn into California, I think those probably were more persuasive because that's identity politics, Armentano said. Don Murphy, a cannabis lobbyist and former GOP Maryland legislature, told Marijuana that he had partial blame on the campaign itself, which displayed a certain amount of arrogance by signaling in the lead-up to Election Day that they thought they were going to win and acted like they were going to win, and they didn't want to hear from anybody who suggested otherwise. Marijuana Moment reached out to Smart and Safe Florida for comment, but a representative deferred to official campaign statements that emphasized the fact that Amendment 3, while unsuccessful, still saw strong majority support from voters. While the results of Amendment 3 did not clear the 60% threshold, we are eager to work with the governor and legislative leaders who agree with us on decriminalizing recreational marijuana for adults, addressing public consumption, continuing our focus on child safety, and expanding access to safe marijuana through home grow, the campaign said. While what's not clear is to what extent Trulieve and other marijuana companies that funded the unsuccessful campaign to enact Amendment 3 will invest in lobbying efforts to convince Florida lawmakers to enact those kinds of cannabis reforms in 2020 and subsequent legislative sessions. So a whole lot going on with that as well. But as we said, Florida's marijuana legalization effort failed. We do know that it's a more difficult balloting system when you're talking about amending Florida's constitution, because it does require that supermajority of 60%. And even though they got close, they weren't able to put it on the top. When you factor in the amount of money DeSantis spent on his intentionally deceiving advertising to try to defeat this measure for reasons that he's never been able to explain, those favoring legalization really found that the deck was stacked against them. And that's unfortunate. I can't quite understand Ron DeSantis' motivation to do things this way. It doesn't benefit him. It hurts him because of all the money that Florida is now losing out on. All the people that come to Florida as tourists, all the people that live in Florida. Many of them like to smoke marijuana. They buy their marijuana from out of state. They bring it from home. The one place they don't get it is from licensed marijuana dispensaries in Florida because they don't exist. And that's a real problem. A state that size should be a leader in this industry, not pulling up at, you know, around the tail position. They should be out there, and if DeSantis is really interested, he should be helping frame the message so that this message does get out. People understand the truth about what's behind marijuana. And it does, I think Fort Lauderdale might be a slightly calmer and more attractive place over spring break if all of those college students were getting high instead of drinking themselves silly. Just saying, something to think about all those times when we hear about people getting so drunk down there over spring break and all the problems that it causes. So we'll leave Florida with Governor DeSantis and his false and phony advertising trying to convince people against all of the studies that we've talked about over the last few years, and we're about to talk again in 30 seconds, that marijuana has no medical benefits or real propriety, and that those who use it only want to use it as a means to get high. I'm not sure that DeSantis knows what that means, to get high, but that's his problem, not ours. So, once again, newly published research that combines an academic literature review with a survey of university students concludes that marijuana is likely an effective tool in reducing harm caused by opioid use disorder, while noting that perceptions and knowledge vary. Upon a review of the literature, it is reasonable to conclude that cannabis has some efficacy in the setting of opiate maintenance, as well as other therapeutic uses, says the new paper. In light of public concerns over opioid overdoses and the possibility of marijuana being rescheduled, it adds, there is a distinct possibility that cannabis use in harm reduction models will increase. The review first looks to available evidence on the use of marijuana as a substitute for opioids and other drugs, noting that at least some studies have indicated that cannabinoids can help reduce opioid-related cravings and withdrawal symptoms. It also points to self-reported data suggesting some people are already reducing opioid use in favor of cannabis. Current research suggests that cannabis has a great deal of potential for opioid-related harm reduction and substitute therapies. The study, which is an Augsburg University master thesis by author Clark Furlong, says cannabis is shown to improve opioid analgesic effects while reducing patient tolerance and dependence. There is well-documented research on the efficacy of cannabis for substitution of illicit drugs, opiates, and pharmaceuticals, opioids. In animal models, cannabinoids have been shown to reduce the effects of opiate withdrawal and anecdotally in humans. As such, it continues, cannabis could have the potential to decrease adverse outcomes and reduce drug-seeking behavior in patients with opioid addictions. The paper acknowledged that marijuana use carries its own risk, but also notes that those risks are complicated and often patient-specific. For instance, it says, some people may use cannabis to manage depression, while cannabis use may precede depression in others. Therefore, we need to learn about the drugs and its nuances, Furlong continues, noting that clearly more research is needed to understand how the substance can be beneficial to some, but potentially detrimental to others. On potential, however, the paper notes that risks associated with cannabis are far less severe than those around opioids. Cannabis may have some harms associated with it. However, there appear to be far less with opioid use, it says. It's therefore possible that cannabis can improve lives and produce better outcomes when compared to the current model of opioid substitution maintenance therapy. Despite years of record opioid-related deaths, treatment has not changed, the study asserts, nor has there been much effort in pharmacological advancement with opiate addiction interventions. Even opiate addicts undergo treatment face a mortality rate that is 12 times greater than that of the average public. Meanwhile, methadone is a drug used in some medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder, often has side effects such as sleep difficulties, problems with sexual performance, and cardiovascular incidents, it says. The paper contends that many people should be detoxified and tapered off the drug, which is how it was designed to be used in maintenance programs, but that research and policymakers overlook adverse events and side effects for long-term methadone use due to subjects' reported improvements in quality of life. results of the survey, of the new paper, generally show support for the notion that cannabis could be a promising tool for managing opioid use disorder. So 70% of the respondents said they believe there are more harms associated with opioids use than marijuana, and similar portions said cannabis can be used to manage pain as well as to manage withdrawal symptoms of opiates. About 65%, meanwhile, said they said that they've known someone in the past year who used marijuana for a quote-unquote off-label medical purpose. About two-thirds of respondents answered that they believe cannabis has a positive effect on mental health, but some said they believe cannabis may have a negative effect on mental health. Overall, 8 in 10 survey respondents also said they believe cannabis should be legalized. Trends in the literature suggest cannabis has a better side effect profile and less severe long-term health effects than opioids, the study says. Most participants feel as if more harms were associated with opiates. This was an impetus of this study, and the survey results reflect the conclusions of the literature. Cannabis has been shown to reduce pain, and there is growing evidence of a symbiotic relationship between cannabis receptors and opiate receptors. It continues, the study population seems to be educated about cannabis use in a pain setting. This reflects the literature, as it has many applications in cancer settings, chronic pain, and even palliative care. For now, Furlong acknowledges studies around the cannabis and opioids are small and often performed with many limitations, but says researchers believe that there will be an explosion of data in the coming year with the coming years with the changing public perception of cannabis and the potential rescheduling of cannabis on the federal level. Nonetheless, the proven efficacy of cannabis in pain management and cancer, coupled with other uses, benefits, and rather safe side effect profile lineup, make it an excellent candidate for future exploration and substitute addiction research, the study said. It's just a constant thing that we're finding. All of these, again, positive benefits that marijuana brings to the table. Once again, as we just said a few minutes earlier, it has great potential to treat opioid use disorder. It will become more common in treatment, and rightfully so, it should. And it's something that just needs to be available for everyone to be able to have an opportunity to use at this stage of the game. And this continued nonsense just causes problems. People are smart enough to be able to figure this out on their own. They don't need the doctors to tell them. They're telling the doctors that it's effective. They're telling the doctors what they like. The doctors are following along, but with no prior medical history on this, they're trying to learn as they go along. So this is where we're at with that. One final story that I think is just kind of funny and certainly seems to suggest that everything with marijuana is a little bit crazy. The Colorado Springs voters recently approved two competing ballot measures this week, one that would ban retail marijuana in the city and another that would allow existing medical marijuana stores to also sell recreationally. As of 6 p.m. Last Wednesday night, about 53% of voters approved ballot issue 2D, as in David, a city charter amendment referred by city council that would prohibit sales within city limits. About the same share of voters also approved ballot question 300, an initiated ordinance which would allow the approximately 90 medical marijuana stores in the city to apply for recreational licenses. Mayor Yemi Mobolade said the result creates a really interesting legal drama for us. Although the election is not final until the results are certified, it appears as though ballot question 2D and ballot question 300 will have been approved by the voters. If this is the case, ballot question 300 must be read, interpreted, and implemented in a manner to be consistent and harmonious with ballot question 2D, city spokesperson Max D'Onofrio wrote in an email. The city charter takes precedence over ordinances, so provision of ballot question 300 that conflict with ballot issue 2D cannot be implemented, which appears to mean recreational marijuana sales would continue to be outlawed. D'Onofrio said the city is currently studying and reviewing the ballot language, and they next meet, just a few days from now, on the 13th. At the time, backers of ballot issue 2D are optimistic when all the votes are counted and the will of the voter is given effect, responsible regulation will be law, and the city council's cynical ploy will be defeated. Citizens for responsible marijuana regulation said in a statement. We know that those in municipal government will defer to the clearly expressed intent of voters to authorize recreational marijuana, and we look forward to working with city leaders over the coming months to create a responsible regulatory framework. So, yeah, you know, things can get a little bit crazy there from time to time, and people just kind of lose track of what they're doing and what they're not doing, but hopefully people over there in Colorado Springs will get it right, and things will go on. You know, as for Florida, well, you know, hopefully they can get a little more organized next time, and they can really bring this issue out in the forefront and demonstrate to the voters not just why it's good, but why DeSantis is using crazy tactics as a means to try to stop it. And, you know, ultimately he was successful. So I guess, you know, we do have to acknowledge that the strategy worked in terms of what he was trying to accomplish, but just, you know, again, begs the question of why did he feel that was a necessary result? Why did he feel the need to specifically go after the will of the voters? Why did he feel the need to try to put in place something that favored his own ideals rather than those of the people that voted him into office? And I think that that's a very, very difficult question, and that the people of Florida would do well to stop and consider it and really kind of put that question back to Governor DeSantis, not only in this context, but apparently it could come up in other contexts. I think it became an issue, the governor's heavy hand trying to tip the scales on their proposal to amend the Constitution to allow for the right of abortion, which DeSantis was very much against, again, for his own reasons. And so he campaigned against it very hard, a sitting officer, which you're not supposed to do, but he did, and he used tax money that was collected from people of the state to try to support it, even though, again, that's not what you're supposed to do down in Florida. But the governor doesn't seem to have any problem when it's for his own best interest in supporting proposals and policies in which he believes. So we're going to move on. The only two other things I want to just talk about under marijuana news, as we get to this from time to time, but not always. But this week, we're going to get to strains of the week. The favorite strain going around that I really, really like is Sub-Zero. It is a potent indica-dominant hybrid cannabis strain that combines the robust genetics of Afghan, Colombian, and Mexican origins. This marijuana strain offers a complex flavor profile with notes of apple, menthol, chestnut, lime, and berry, providing a unique and refreshing sensory experience. The aroma of Sub-Zero is intriguing as its flavor, characterized by a rich combination of woody, earthy, and citrus notes, thanks to a terpene profile rich in humulene, limonene, linalool, and carine. These terpenes not only enhance the flavor, but also contribute to the strain's therapeutic properties. I find that I like Sub-Zero later in the day, after work is done, maybe after I get home before dinner. It does kind of help bring me down, mellow me out, get rid of the stress of the day, get ready to have a little dinner, sit back and enjoy the evening before possibly switching over to a stronger indica for later in the evening consumption, which will help me get ready to go to bed and have a good night's sleep. But the other strain that I want to talk about today that I've been enjoying very much is Apple Fritter, or also known as Apple Fritters, plural, I guess, is a rare, evenly balanced hybrid strain, 50-50 indica and sativa, created through crossing the classic sour apple and animal cookie strains. Best known for making the High Times 2016 World's Strongest Strains list, this baby brings on a hard-hitting high and super delicious flavors that will have you begging for more after just one taste. Now, admittedly, you got to be a little more careful with Apple Fritter. It may not be your best on my way to work strain or lunchtime strain when you still have to go back to the office. But again, towards the end of the day, it's a great strain to really get you home and you know, maybe get your evening off to a good start. It can give you a good high. And the fact that it's 50-50, it doesn't really drag you down or make you very tired like a really strong indica or sometimes even a strong sativa can once that initial high kind of goes away. So I've enjoyed both of these strains very much. I would suggest if you could get your hands on either one of them, that you give them a test go and see what you think. And if you want to write into podconnects.com, sorry, we will be very, very happy to hear about it and comment on it too. So we love when we hear from people. On the extract side, I've been enjoying very much Dolce Limon, which is a hybrid sativa dominant and Pineapple Fizz, which is a slightly indica-dominant hybrid strain. They're both more of a batter type of consistency, which is nice to use. It makes it a little bit easier to control when you use the liquids. They tend to kind of drip all over the place and get all over your fingers, and it makes a real mess. So I like things that are a little more solid, as it were, and these strains are very, very workable. They have great a great smell, a great taste, and really pack a good punch when mixed up with some of those strains I was mentioning and other strains. It's a really, really effective, I think, buzz along the way, and that's really nice. So those are my strains of the day. That's my marijuana news of the week. And we are now going to dive back into November 11th, 1973 at Winterland, the third night of a three-night run that was just absolutely excellent and which can be captured on the box set that was released by the Dead, the complete recordings of the November 1973 three-night run. And here's where we go now with the show. We had talked about coming out of the second set, Mississippi Half Step, into Big River, into Dark Star. And then as we come out of Dark Star, the boys throw a little bit of a Mind Left Body jam that we'll talk about in a minute. But let's go ahead and listen to it right now. Thank you. So what we just heard there was the passage out of Dark Star. It's a like 36 minute Dark Star that's amazing. Into this Mind Left Body Jam, and then into Eyes of the World. So here's what I got to say about it. The Mind Left Body Jam is the name given to a four-chord sequence played as a jam by the Grateful Dead. It is thought by some to be related to the Paul Kantner Jefferson Airplane song, Your Mind Has Left Your Body. The mind title Mind Left Body Jam was originally used by Dead Bass. The first Grateful Dead CD to include a version was Dozin' at the Nick, featuring 1990 shows from Albany, New York, where it was titled the Mud Love Buddy Jam in a humorous reference to the Dead Bass taper title. But subsequent releases have adopted the Mind Left Body Jam title. So we said here it comes out of a 36-minute Dark Star that many say is one of the best ever and links it to an excellent Eyes of the World. It's fun to feature one of the band's thematic jams every now and then, the truly improvisational side of the Dead and their live performances. The Mind Left Body Jam, as it's known, there's 9 official performances of it. Doesn't mean that there wasn't other occasions where they played it. Their first time was October 19th, 1973 at the Jim Norrick Arena in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. They last played it on March 24th, 1990, as we said, at the Knickerbocker Arena in Albany, New York. Interestingly, the band Phish also has a version of a Mind Left Body Jam that I have not heard them play, but is their own version of the message. So, great minds think alike, and there you have it. So this Mind Left Body Jam then was the transition from the Dark Star, went on its way for a minute or two till it turns and dives right into Eyes, and so recognizable at the beginning. Again, going back to David Dodd, Eyes of the World is a Robert Hunter lyric set by Jerry Garcia. It appeared in concert for the first time in that same show on February 9th, 1973 at the Maples Pavilion at Stanford University, along with They Love Each Other, China Doll, Here Comes Sunshine, Loose Lucy, Row Jimmy, and Wave That Flag, all bust outs. Its final performance by the Dead was on July 6, 1995 at the Riverport Amphitheater in Maryland Heights, Missouri, when it opened the second set and led into Unbroken Chain. It was performed 381 times, with 49 of those performances occurring in 1973. It was released on Wake of the Flood in November 1973. The 49 performances in 73 clearly show the pattern of new songs being played in heavy rotation when they are first broken out, and then either falling away entirely or setting into a more steady, less frequent pattern as the years go by. Makes absolute sense, but doesn't really apply to everything, because there's some songs that do get, you know, every third or fourth show treatment, and have for years and years. Sometimes criticized lyrically as being a bit too hippy-dippy for its own good, Eyes of the World might be heard as conveying message of hope, viewing human consciousness as having value for the planet as a whole. There are echoes in the song of wide range of literary and musical influences, from Blaise Pascal to perhaps Ken Kesey, from talk of Redeemer to the title of the song itself. In an interview, Hunter made an interesting statement about the Songs of Our Own line, which appear twice in Eyes of the World. He said he thinks it's possible each of us may have some tune or song that we hum or sing to ourselves, nothing particular, amazing, or fine, necessarily, that is our own song. Our song. It's just that's what it is. The song leaves plenty of room for our own interpretation of certain lines and sections. The verses about the Redeemer fading away, being followed by a clay-laden wagon. The myriad of images of birds, beaches, flowers, seeds, horses. It's one of my all-time favorite songs, dead or otherwise. It's a perfect jam tune, great lyrics, fun sing-along chorus, and some of the finest music you'll ever hear between the verses. I first really fell for this tune while at a small show one night in my junior year at Michigan. In the Michigan Union, there was a Cleveland-based Dead cover band called Ouroboros. We were all dancing, and this tune came out of nowhere and just seemed to go on forever. I recognized it, put two and two together that it was the Dead tune, and said, oh my God, I really love this tune, and went back and found it on one of my Dead albums, or few tapes that I had at that time, the beginning of my collection. Eyes of the World is just always fun, no matter where you get it in a show. And I was at that show
where it was opened in the second set and came out and did that. It was a lot of fun and a great show to see and a great way to see the show. Just very, very excited about that. One of the final shows in St. Louis, and they did it, and it just worked out so nice. So I did my standard Dead Die. I found as many of the song versions of the song as I could, and just went crazy with it. I would often follow Estimated Prophet in the first part of the second set, China Rider Estimated Eyes, or Scarlet Fire Estimated Eyes, and sometimes even a Help Slip Frank Estimated Eyes, sometimes just an Estimated Eyes. Last week, of course, we heard an Eyes Estimated, but that was about the only time you're ever going to hear that. Regardless of where it appeared, hearing the opening notes was magical, because you knew that for the next 10 to 12 minutes, Jerry Garcia had you in the palm of his hand. And this was just a great version, coming out of the Dark Star, Mind Left Bonnie Jam, and then continuing on into China Doll, two great Jerry tunes in a row, a standout Sugar Mag to close out the second set. Any 73 Eyes will leave you in awe, and this one is one of the best. Eyes played 382 times, February 9th, 1973, Maples Pavilion, Stanford University in California, for its first appearance. Last appearance, July 6th, 1995, at the Riverport Amphitheater, Maryland Heights, St. Louis, Missouri. So we are reaching the very end of this week's episode. We do have a final tune to take you out, and we bid you good night, and we'll talk about that in 1 minute. In that mode of time where we're getting ready to head into Thanksgiving weekend. I always like the Friday, Black Friday of Thanksgiving weekend. It's a National Record Store Day event, and you can get to your own local record stores and find out what they're selling, and usually they've got some great stuff, whether it's dead or otherwise, but the dead are usually pretty good at putting out a selection each time. I don't think I've heard what it's going to be this go around, but based on the stuff they've put out in the past, it's always a lot of fun. So it's never too early to start thinking about that, contacting your local record store, seeing if they do it, and heck, why not just go down there and buy a couple of albums if you have a turntable you can play it on. Rediscover the beauty of vinyl and keep these guys in business so that we all have a continuing source to get vinyl to listen to beautiful music as that source. So on the way out the door on November 11th, 1983, 1973, the Grateful Dead played "And We Bid You Good Night." They performed the song a number of times in 68, from 68 to 70, and 89 to 90 periods, but infrequently during the rest of their performing career, not so much. On Grateful Dead recordings, the title used is either "And We Bid You Good Night" or just "We Bid You Good Night." The Grateful Dead version of this traditional lowering down funeral song originates from a recording by Joseph Spence and the Pindar family, which was released in 1965. The title used on that recording, as on many others, is "I Bid You Good Night." The song appears to share a common ancestry with the song "Sleep On, Beloved" from Northeast England. I got to see it the first night at Alpine Valley in 1989, the Dead's last year at Alpine, and it really caught the crowd off guard. Great reaction from Deadheads, kind of chills you down to your spine, the acapella nature of the way they sing it, Jerry just kind of going on and on like he's preaching at you, walking in Jerusalem just like John. I was with One-Armed Larry and good buddy Alex. They had both been with us at Deer Creek right before. Larry stayed for all three Alpine shows, but Alex had to take off after that first night. Great times had by all. One of the few shows I do not have a ticket stub for, because either Larry or Alex used it to get stubbed down off the lawn into the pavilion seats, and I never got it back. So that's my one haul. That's okay. It was fun to be with them and being able to sit together and just really all, you know, enjoying this as much as we could. So we talk about "We Bid You Good Night." Played 69 times, first on January 26, 1968, at Eagles Auditorium in Seattle, Washington. Last played on September 26, 1991, at the Boston Garden in Boston. Thank you for listening, everyone. Join us again next week for more music news, marijuana news, and other featured Grateful Dead show that'll be fun to listen to. Have a great week. Have fun. Be safe. And as always, enjoy your cannabis responsibly. And we bid you good night.
I want you to lay your bid you good night. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. And I bid you good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
And I bid you good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Just like dawn.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Lay down, my dear brother.
Lay down and take your rest.
I want you to lay your head
upon your Savior's breast.
Good night.
And I bid you good night.
Good night.